views. And one night, somebody came backstage and said, you know, I represent Sid Caesar. He's looking for a straight man, second banana.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow. He said, Sid might be interested in you. Would you like to meet him? No, no promises. I said, sure.
Yeah.
So the next day, he picked me up, and I went with him to Sid's house, Sid Caesar's house. We went, and we sat down, and Sid came up to me, and he said, tell me, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from New York. He said, do you come from New York? Do you know that there are a lot of Hispanic people in New York? And I caught on what he was doing. I said, so I replied. I said, yes, I know New York very well. Very mucho Hispanic people there. My people are Hispanic, which they really aren't.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, so he went on like this with the Spanish accent. After about a minute, he said, by the way, there's also Irish people there. And I used to sit there and pick it up. He said, well, I did the same thing. My folks had a diner.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at his manager who was there. He says, book the man. Sign him up.
Wow.
And that's the reason. And I've told many young actors, don't just play yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to play comedy. Because I've done comedy. I've played heavies. In fact, my nom de plume is Crooks, Cops, and Comedy.
Yeah.
Someone gave me that title years ago because I played a lot of crooks, I played a lot of cops,
mm-hmm.
I did a lot of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
The more versatile you are, not only as an actor, but even as a magician, you just don't do just one style of magic, do very various styles.
Mm-hmm. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. We have reached the end of this six-part series of My Week at the Magic Castle 2015. When I first started recording for this series, I had no idea how many one-hour podcasts I would record, but I was thrilled that so many friends agreed to spend time and chat with me on the record for this podcast. I could have put them all in one long podcast, but I know that an elephant is best eaten one bite at a time. While recording these podcasts, I learned a lot and had some laughs. I hope that you did too. This week, we start off with Entertainment Director of the Academy of Magical Arts, Mr. Jack Goldfinger, who talks a bit about booking acts for the Magic Castle. Next up is Tony Clark, who was working in the parlor but is also a producer of magic shows. He has several projects in mind that he's working on, but he talks about some of the venues where he's worked. Jonathan Neil Brown was performing in the Palace, and I caught up with him at the Owl Bar at the Castle before one of his last shows of the week. He talks about his shows in Vegas, aboard cruise ships, and other venues, and how he has kept moving along in this economy as the market has changed. We then go in a different direction in a conversation with Lee Delano. He was an actor and partner with Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca, among others. He was also in the original Planet of the Apes as one of the apes. Or was he a chimpanzee? I don't remember. But you can see the picture on the website. He was also in an episode of Star Trek and many other movies and TV shows. We then come full circle from part one of this series when Newell Unfred shared stories of his days at Hollywood Magic working with Ray Pierce, among others. Well, we finished this podcast and this series speaking with two of those employees, Christopher Hart and Ray Pierce. They share some great stories about those days from long ago and working in one of the nation's premier magic shops in the heart of Hollywood. So, now you know who's on first. No, who's on second? Then who's on first? Oh well, let's not get bogged down in that classic comedy bit. Let's hear from some classic conjurers at the castle, now, on The Magic Word. Scott Wells here for the Magic Word Podcast.com. And in the close-up gallery, just before my final show here on Friday night, and we have Entertainment Director, Mr. Jack Goldfinger. Mr. Goldfinger, how are you, sir?
I am happy.
Happy, that's good. Well, you're always happy. You always have a smile on your face, it seems.
Well, I found out I control my attitude, and I selected happy.
Yeah, you're right. Nobody else can do it but you. You know, you can look at two different ways of life, of trying to always be upset about something, or you can decide that's not going to faze me.
Well, happiness is also an inside job.
Mm-hmm. I like that. That's something that you're going to have to do inside. Because I like that. That's a very philosophical way of looking at life.
Oh, well, I'm speaking to you sort of under a handicap.
What's that?
Doc Eason's not here. The last time we spoke, Doc Eason was here.
That's true, last year, yeah.
It was really comforting. But Doc is downstairs working in the at the bar in the W.C. Fields yes. bar in the Inner Circle. Isn't
right.
that amazing?
Yeah, it is. How that always
is that
how that
serendipitous
works.
Or what?
We'll need to talk to the entertainment director to see how he lines these things up.
Wow.
Like this. He must know what's going on.
I have no idea. My picture is not on the money.
So, as the entertainment director, you have to stick around here, and do you get much time off? To travel to, I know, like, for an example, last year, I remember, or a few years ago, you went to Magic Live, and you were doing, you and Dove were doing the Torn Restored newspaper, I think it's part of Gene Anderson's thing. It was very, very cool. And so you get a kind of dash away from a day or two, but do you ever take, like, a vacation, I mean, like a real vacation to go to, like, Bermuda or something?
Wow. The dictionary defines the word vacation as absent of thought.
Mm.
And, I recently had a bout with the flu.
Oh, okay.
And so I was kind of down for about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that wasn't a vacation.
Not at all.
All of the emails that piled up.
Sure.
I mean, you leave this. So, yeah, but it worked out quite well. Everyone understood. I learned this thing called an automatic reply.
Yes.
And most of the people were understanding, and they got back to me mm-hmm. accordingly, and we answered all the emails in the order in which they were received.
Right. Yeah. As I recall, I think that's what your autoresponder said. We will get back to you in the order they were received over there. You
yeah.
about ready, Alex? Alexis, to load them up
I
soon?
Can wait.
Okay,
can
wait just
yeah,
to...
about plenty of time.
Okay, if we do,
oh,
just whenever
nice.
You let me know.
Okay.
She's wonderful.
Nice.
You know, I think the most wonderful people work here at the Magic Castle. Everyone has a smile to the person. I did a chat with Patrick Beneful or Bennyworth, I think, who is the butler.
Yes,
and
very good guy.
Very good guy. And again, he was just saying, yeah, to a person, everyone here is just fun to work with and work for.
Well, we had a gentleman here who's going to the 4F, like yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you might see him there. There's Aster and Galamos.
Yes, they were just here last week, yeah.
Well, Galamos mm-hmm. had a musical issue that he was using a CD player,
mm-hmm.
and Alexis saw that it was challenging for him and went out and got him an iPod Nano. And then took the thing home with his music, put the music on the Nano, came
yeah.
back, hooked it up for him
wow.
on her day off. So that's
that says a lot, doesn't
walking
it?
The second mile. Yeah,
yeah, yeah then for
so,
sure.
So the service you can and the cooperation at the now Academy of Magical Arts at the Magic Castle.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the AMA, that I just spent some time with Joe Furlow talking on the podcast a couple of days ago, and he was bringing me all up to date on what's been happening since he has come in as a general manager and
mm-hmm.
and how all the changes have come about and how financially they've...
One of the best things that has ever happened to the club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has been successful, perhaps in spite of itself
it's
over the year, but it's
the best thing that mm-hmm. has happened to
yeah.
the club.
Well, he's looking at it as a business manager
yes.
As well, and,
yes.
and also has the right people in place,
yes.
such as yourself and others.
And we have the right board in place.
Right.
I guess I go back to one of the best things, because it's not, there's a whole bunch of links to this chain now.
Sure. Yeah, he was saying
it a success.
He was saying how that they had, unfortunately, some people had to leave, and so they started out, they have maybe 15 people or so less than what he first came on staff, and as he's kind of pared it down and also changed the valet service and a lot of different things that have changed. Of course, then adding the butler and then getting the rooms that we have then are available now and all these kinds of things that have made it a better first-class kind of a thing that's made it profitable. And not only that, but from a magician's point of view, a great place to work. It always has been, but it's even better now that it's profitable. So
a closed door is just as much a blessing as an open one.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Every time, you always just lay these gems out here. You always have just some great words of wisdom. Just you don't even. You probably should write a book of these things.
Yeah.
Dove probably says you're full of it, though, too.
Well, if you see the book, it'll be called Jack and Ease.
Jack and Ease. I like that.
Yes. That's what we're looking towards, that title, if ever
yeah.
such a... But it's not my saying. This is things that people have shared with me, and
mm-hmm.
I have been able to retain them.
And incorporate them.
I read them, and then I eat the cookie.
Yeah. I like that. And so what do you think has been... Perhaps the best change that you have seen. A lot of things have happened, but what is one of the best things that, as far as maybe helping you in your particular job?
Oh, I have so much help. I have help from Brian Lee in the palace. I have help from the Board of Trustees. I have help from Max Maven personally and Joe Furlow. You're trying to ask me which one is my favorite best child.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do that.
No, it's a difficult, I understand, question over there of people that are helping. Do people also give you a lot of ideas or suggestions, since, again, that you're not able to take those vacations and travel? Let's say, like, I'm assuming you're not going to FISM this year, but or are you going to be going over to Italy possibly?
I was invited.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think that with who's going over there and representing
yeah.
the organization will be sufficient unto itself.
Right, and so they will be able to bring back some ideas and say, hey, we saw this guy and he was
just
outstanding.
And most of the people who are performing have already performed here. And
mm-hmm.
if it's someone new, they will still have to submit a DVD or a mm-hmm. video online mm-hmm. so that there is evidence and consistency in mm-hmm. what was witnessed.
Sure. Sure.
And a lot of acts that are really acts and terrific mm-hmm. In the competition state. How much time does FISM give an act to perform?
I think it depends upon whether it's a stage or close-up, but it seems like it's about 12 minutes or so, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. So mm-hmm. We do here at least over 15,
right.
less than 20. And in the Palace, that show is 40 minutes long.
And Peller also.
45 to the max, yes. So everything works for itself, mm-hmm. and yes.
Right. And so people will give you these great ideas of saying, hey, you need to see so-and-so, or this guy was really great, and then they can still submit something to you to make sure that everything's fine.
Oh, yes, yes. A lot of acts mm-hmm. that have been here recently were acts that were suggested by people in a position that you would know they know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, I think it's about that time. Looks like, yeah, why don't we start to load them up?
Okay.
That'll be good.
Thank you, Jack, very much.
Oh, as always, that was Jack Goldfinger for the Magic Word Podcast. Scotty out.
Rolling now.
We should. Hi, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Sitting here in the parlor, and it's on Saturday at night, and it's going to be crazy busy here at the castle very shortly. And I have been working the early close-up in the gallery, and my friend Tony Clark has been working the early parlor, so we've not been able to see each other's act. Just we've been hearing about how good. I mean, you should see this other guy's act. And so I'm here with Tony Clark. Hey, Tony.
How are you, Scott?
How's your week going? I'm doing great, thank you, by the way. How's your week?
It's going good. You know, it's great. Castle's always fun.
Yeah. Now, you live in the L.A. area, so you
yes.
come here fairly regular? Or?
Yeah, I come like once every week or other week, yeah, mm-hmm. when I'm in town.
Mm-hmm.
It's just great to see friends and like people like yourself. I haven't seen mm-hmm. you in a while,
yeah.
so it's nice. So it's a combination of getting good crowds and seeing some friends as well.
Yeah. As far as when you're performing, do you normally perform here? I would think you're really kind of a palace guy.
This is the first time I ever performed here in 28 years.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. All the more reason I wish I was getting to see
I
your
never
show.
Did a parlor. Jack Goldfinger has been asking me for as long as he's been entertainment director. I've done the palace all my career.
That's what I would think, sure.
Yeah, then he wants me to do close-up. So I said, let me do the parlor. I have some new stuff. I wrote a whole one-hour show for myself. A stand-up show, and I'm doing parts of it here.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out well.
Where are you performing that full show? Have you got a place around?
No, I'm thinking about... I have one venue that's... actually, two different venues I'm working on that I mm-hmm. might actually own. So we'll see.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I know that you've been booking a lot of other shows. I mean, I got a timeshare in Tahoe, and I get out there then, and I've seen the shows that you book, and these guys are out there for like a year at a time. Are you still booking that and others, or?
Yeah, we're always looking for places. It's all about the venue,
oh,
right?
Sure.
The Horizon now is the Hard Rock.
Oh, I didn't know they changed.
Yes,
okay.
They changed.
That was just like within the last...
Yes, within the last 8 months.
Yeah, okay, I haven't been out there.
So that, you know, that was like my home up there.
Yeah, it was.
I was there in 1996 to 2000, and then I was away for a year, then went back and produced shows for the next 10 years, on
mm-hmm.
and off.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now I've got different venues. I can't say yet, but
sure.
I'm working on two venues that are going to be very interesting.
But the thing with the Hard Rock, I assume, is kind of like, what, Live Nation or somebody that maybe books through...
Yeah, they don't. They're looking for, you know, bands and comics. Yeah, and they, my little showroom is gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they ripped it out.
That was such a beautiful place.
Yeah, it was a great little cabaret. It was like tables and little booths.
Mm-hmm.
It was like 220, very cozy.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad seat in the house. So they just tore it out, which it needed to be torn out. Don't get me wrong.
It was fairly old. Yeah.
Yeah, I would have renovated it and kept it.
Mm-hmm.
It was so cool. But they want, you know, the Hard Rock look. So
sure.
It's life. You know, I got 14 years out of that place.
Right.
Well, I can't complain.
You can't complain about
right.
that, that's for sure.
Right.
Now, I thought you were up also on North Lake Tahoe. Didn't you something up in that way around Truckee or something?
No, I did something last year in Reno at the Grand Sierra.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
okay.
The world's biggest stage. We had a show there. We called it Masters of Magic and had two illusionists, and it was a big show.
That is the world's largest stage.
Oh,
I've been on that. I know what you're talking about because I remember that Kaylin and Ginger were performing there, and someone had produced a jumbo jet, and they still had it in backstage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That jet's been there for, I don't know, 40 years.
Oh, really?
Oh, Hello Hollywood, hello. It was a set piece.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, it's a three-quarter scale 747.
And the stage is so large, it actually accommodates that and fits.
It's there in the back. It sits in the back. It's gigantic. My feet were hurting. I remember the second day of rehearsals, I'm like, why are my feet hurting? I'm like, because I'm walking around a mile a day, half a mile back and forth almost.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I remember watching an MC out. I wish I would have thought of this bit. It was so funny that he walked part way, and then he stopped, and he pulled out this lunch bag, and he had a sandwich, and then he walked the rest of the way to the middle of the stage.
Yes. It's amazing. We actually had to cut out not a lot of the audience participation, but every time somebody came on stage, it would add 3 minutes to the show.
Wow.
Because it took a minute and a half to get on, a minute and a half to get off.
Mm-hmm.
So the show was running like 15 or 20 minutes overtime. So I had to reconstruct guys, have them use them on the edge of the have people come to the edge of the stage as opposed to coming on the stage.
Right.
So and then maybe having nobody come on stage. So I finally got it down, but I didn't realize, oh my God, it's adding like 15 to 20 minutes to the show.
There was a logistics that you really don't think about until you actually get there. It's like, gosh, I never thought about the stage being that large.
Yeah. People walk, slow. So it was a good learning experience.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
You're still doing a lot of lectures. Have you ever done like a penguin lecture, by the way?
I have not done the penguin lecture. They've been asking me about the penguin lecture. I just haven't been out there.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some lectures for you, and I appreciate your work when I try to book a few of my like ones off lectures. And like, wow, that's a pain in the butt. I'm doing one lecture. Scott could do 20 in a row. I admire your work. Thank you. I appreciate it. So I appreciate you more than ever. Yeah.
Thank you. I remember when you were working with Jeff Hobson on his lecture network thing, and that was really a great fun
that,
thing.
You know what? He was 5 years ahead of his time.
He really was. Yep.
He was 5 years ahead. Did you ever see that studio?
Oh, I did. I came, in fact, that he and I talked about it, and then as he was going on to something else, now the story can be told, I guess. I haven't ever related this publicly, but he and I talked, and he was going to sell the thing to me, and I was seriously considered moving to Las Vegas and actually taking that over.
It was so well done. They had beautiful cameras, all remote controlled. They had like three or four different colored curtains that rolled in and out. And I did three lectures for him.
Yeah. I remember the Dove from Kleenex Box.
Yes. Cool, I did even a kid's lecture just to help him out, and I pulled out my old kid's stuff, and I did a kid's lecture, and he had his little kids show up. But it was so well done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was not back then. People weren't watching on
That's
a computer.
Right. That's right. They weren't.
Not yet. And I'm like, oh, my God, he was so ahead of his time. Now, he'd rock it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think he kind of blazed the trail, at least to kind of found out where the pockmarks are, a little bit the potholes and some of the problems. But I don't recall, though, that he had actually had a nice studio, but he didn't have an audience area for a lot of people to come and watch that.
No, he didn't. No, I just, like, for the kids.
It was very small, yeah.
It was very small, but it was so nicely done, though. Mm-hmm. The lighting was perfect. They had a control booth. And now the videos are out. Todd Carr bought the videos.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Monty Lectures, they're out on that, on his line. They're out there. I have them.
I had someone just recently saying that there was a Dove routine that Tony had done in a lecture a while back, where I can get in touch with it. And I didn't know that Todd had the rights to that. I said, well, you need to get a hold of Tony.
Yes.
And I don't know if they did or not. But
I think that one's called Insight and Illusions or Professional Children's Magic. I can't remember which one it's in, but it's one of those two lectures. It's out there.
If they want to find that, we're going to...
It's on my site. I have it on my site.
Which is?
TonyClarkMagic.com/shop/magic shop.
Not shop magic, but magic shop.
Yeah, shop, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But if you go to TonyClarkMagic.com, I have a landing page now. It has all my sites on it, all four different businesses. My consulting, my production company, my products, and my corporate site.
And on your consulting, do you do a lot of directing and aside from producing, as far as working with like what Joni Spina used to do?
Yeah, lately, this last year has been a lot. I did a TV, in the last 3 weeks, I did a TV commercial. I did an epic battles of rap, epic rap battles of history. It's a huge internet sensation.
Really?
They make over 50 to 100 million views.
Holy
so I did a consulting on that. And then I did a thing for Late Show with James Corden, the new TV show. Mm-hmm. So it's been like, it's been good. I've been a lot of good TV and film stuff lately.
Starting to get your name out a little bit, so that way.
Yeah, people call me. I just got a call for this giant AIDS fundraiser, and all these big stars are in it. And this guy,
here
I worked,
in LA.
Yeah, I worked 2 years ago on this TV show called First Family. And he was the prop master, and he called me. He says, "Hey, we need you to help us with this big thing." I said, "Okay, cool."
Right, right.
Yeah.
You know, when I look at you, I can't help but think of the great promo photo, of course, of the Doves and doing the Phantom of the Opera kind of a thing.
Sure.
Do you still do that, or is that kind of something you put away?
No, I haven't done that in about 12 years.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
I did. I pulled it out about 2.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I had a guy, an agent from a producer from Malaysia call me. Mm-hmm. He goes, "Oh, I have a show for this second richest man in Malaysia, and he wants what he wants. He showed him your video, and he wants you to come out." I said, "Well, I don't do the act." He goes, "Yeah, but he wants you to come out."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, you know, long story short, I threw out this crazy number,"
yeah.
and he said, "Okay." I'm like, "What?" So there I was.
How
now.
Did you say no?
Yeah, so I took 2 months to get myself in shape.
Yeah,
not really, about a month and a half or so, and then I did the act.
Uh-huh.
I did it again. I revamped all my props, and I did it. Went to the Comedy Magic Club for a couple nights. They let me work out.
Yeah.
Yep, yep, and changed my music, which I wanted to do for a while. And it's funny when you don't see your act for that long.
Mm.
You're like looking at the gimmicks going, "Why did I make that way?
Mm-hmm.
I have a better way to make it." So I really improved these
stuff.
But that's the only time I did it. I haven't done it since.
Well, let me ask about music on that. In that particular case of using something, it's going to be an Andrew Lloyd Webber type of thing that is copyrighted. I've had people who have asked me about the use of copyrighted or ASCAP music.
Yes.
And I say, well, as long as the venue... the venue is the one responsible for having the contract and paying whatever.
Right,
they
pay.
Correct?
Yeah, they pay a blanket type contract to for the premises to play music on the premises. So like the casinos, they pay it already.
Right.
If you're doing a private party, it's, you know, I don't condone it, but you don't really have to.
Yeah, it's a private thing, and so working in someone's home.
Right,
right,
right. Okay. So yeah, but typically you're correct. The big venues do have a ASCAP contract.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so as you develop that, then, and you found, okay, well, here's a better way of doing this particular trick or building something. Did you put it back in or try it, or you just kind of retired? You did it once and then forgot about it again. Or?
I haven't done the act since. Yeah.
Since then, oh,
yeah.
Is that right?
It's a lot of work, you know.
I bet it is.
It's the Doves, and I realized, wow. I remember doing this at the castle 3 times a night. The setup is 25, 30 minutes just to reset everything.
Wow.
And I loved it when I did it, don't get me wrong, but I did it for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's time to move on, you know,
yeah.
and I did. And I do stand-up stuff. I do a variety of stuff, a lot of audience participation stuff in my show. My angle now is really having fun with the audience. I have a little bit of a comedy angle to it. I kind of bring in my heritage now, my talent heritage into it.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple funny stories of relatives and they relate to the tricks and my Uncle Nick and the, you know, with the knife through code and... You know, he used to do it with the person wearing the jacket.
Right.
You know, so I do kind of funny stuff like that. So I enjoy that now, you know.
I think it's important that you stay in character because I remember seeing somebody early on in my magic career who was doing a fairly serious routine, and it was some mentalism, and he had done a floating zombie with a skull and other kinds of things. And then he started doing a Lester Lake guillotine chopper, and it was all the standard lines and was funny, and he had some cartoon calliope music playing, and I thought... This just didn't, for something in my subconscious, just didn't seem right. You just kind of changed characters. It's like doing mentalism and you start to be believable, then you do magic. It's like, wait a minute, I guess the rest of this must have been trickery also.
That's
true. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's very, very important. I have a book that I'm writing, actually, and it's one of the chapters in it. It's about your character, consistent character. You have to let them know who you are up front and stay there. You know, I mean, you could go off a little bit, but like you said, you can't be dramatic and then all of a sudden be this goofy guy.
Right.
You lose credibility.
Mm-hmm.
You have no strength. So I think consistency in the character is very important.
Yeah.
And it actually makes your job easier when you're creating the act. If you know, like me now, a guy came up to me last couple nights ago, goes, "Oh, I love your character." And I said, I'm just being myself.
That's always easiest.
That's the way, if you do that,
that's
great. Or it could be an extension of yourself.
Correct.
But I don't want to think anymore. Mm-hmm. I come on stage. I just do what I do.
That's the best way. Yeah.
It's so enjoyable. I'm sure you find that too.
Yeah, I do.
You're not a character. You do yourself.
Right.
So I think if you could find yourself and really be yourself and be honest on stage and be vulnerable, it's more enjoyable for you and for the audience at the same time.
I agree. On the other hand, that I was talking on a podcast then with Danny Archer, and he was referring to something that he'd learned from John Carney, and that is of having other characters, in which that you know, Danny was doing Joey Mozzarella or something, Tony Mozzarella. It was kind of a mafia kind of a thing. And of course, then John Carney's got Mr. Misto or whatever. And so, in other words, whenever they call you again to book you for another show, well, they've already seen you as a magician, even though that you have a lot of other things in a B and a C show, like you're working cruise ships. You've got different kinds of shows. However, that's like, oh, he's turning you magic, but you know, what else have you got? Well, I've got this character. So if you have a character that is scripted, so.
Sure. Well, yeah, as long as it's an obvious character. And those are obvious characters.
Sure.
Like when John does it, he'll introduce his characters and tell you who they are. Or it's so obviously a character. Mm-hmm. Mr. Misto is such an obvious character. You know, it's not a real person. It's a caricature of a person. But even in his one-man show, he does Fawcett Ross.
Fawcett Ross, right.
And he tells you who it is, and he does it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. That's different, you know. As long as you tell the people what you're doing. But if you all of a sudden switch, like you said,
right,
it's confusing.
Something is confusing. As Vernon says, confusion is not magic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. I was going to ask you, where are you going from here? And you already said you've got a couple of venues and things you're planning on producing and working with.
Yeah, I got a couple of little things I'm working on. I have a little film project that's going to be in the works. And then I'm just doing a little lecture in Reno right next week, for instance. Then I'm going to the Givens Theater, the Theater of Dreams
in Castle Rock.
May 1st and 2nd, doing a lecture and three shows there, which is fun, public shows. Yeah. And then after that, I come back, and then my goal is to finish my book, about 3/4 finished.
Mm-hmm. And what is the title, or working title?
The working title now is Tony Clark Unmasks... Secrets to Mastering the Craft, the Show, and the Business of Magic.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a mouthful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a subtitle. But it's going to be basically a how-to book, everything from, and there'll be tricks in it, too. I have a whole section of magic. Some people contributed. So it's going to be really good. Joseph Gabriel did 80 drawings for me.
Wow. I didn't know he was an artist.
Oh, yeah. He used to do all Tannen stuff years ago.
Did not know
that.
Yeah. I always think of him being the big macaw.
I forgot about it. And I was working with him in Albuquerque last November. And it came up like, oh, my God, that's right. So I'm working on a book. He goes, oh, send me the stuff. And he did all my drawings beautifully done.
Wow.
Beautifully done. Okay. Yeah. So that's my goal now, is to finish the book, because you know that could go on forever if you don't put your mind to it.
I just last evening did a short podcast then with Michael Perovich, and he was saying about how important that it is to get started on a book because it takes so long. And of course, I know, like working with Banachek, trying to give birth to a book is not a 9-month thing like a child. It is years.
Yeah, it takes a while. This is going to go on over a year now.
Yeah,
and it's getting down to the fine point now. So I'm having several people read it. Just doing the fine touch-ups on it.
Right.
But, I read it, and I always want to add stuff. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a point when you have to stop.
That's right. Let's make it a second book.
Right,
yeah,
let's
put that aside. We're going to be focusing
exactly.
Just on that.
So that's what I'm at that point now. I'm done, and just refine this, and let's get this done. So.
And they'll be able to find that on your website, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. TonyClarkMagic.com. Yeah, definitely. TonyClarkMagic.com, and I'll have it maybe some select dealers, perhaps. I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Maybe like H&R Magic Books or somebody?
Maybe. And it's going to come with a USB memory stick.
That's nice. Mm-hmm.
With six interviews.
Mm-hmm.
With Steinmeier. I got I got Jack Goldfinger talking about the castle, how to get booked at the castle. I got the entertainment director, Richard Barrett, from Comedy Magic Club, how to get booked at the Comedy Magic Club. I got how to get on TV stuff with Justin Willman. I have Norm Nielsen talking about the classics of magic, and I got him interviewed, and they're all about an hour-ish. I got my old mentor, my late mentor, Bill Andrews, interview I did with him like 12 years ago. I got him in there. Then I have my Secrets of Winning audio from my old power pack from 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be in there as well.
Now, are these videos or audio?
Audio.
Okay, so it's kind of like a podcast.
It's just interviews. I went to their house and interviewed everybody. Jim Steinmeier's
got
some great stuff. And
oh, yeah.
Really, I mean, everybody has their own different angles, so you get a lot of perspectives from all these different people, and that'll come with the book,
right?
Which would be nice. So it can round the whole book off, So it's basically a how-to book, Stories of Ricky Dunn, a lot of stories on the road, and things that I learned. And like I say in the book, it's like stuff that I'm talking about is stuff that I learned and actually did and experienced. It's not things that I'm talking about, things that actually work, So it should be exciting.
And speaking of Ricky Dunn, there's so many stories about him, but when you mentioned him, was there something that came to mind immediately, a story that you can quickly tell us? As a tip a little bit or a little teaser?
Yeah, just a little teaser. I was on a tour with him in New Zealand for 3 weeks, And he's a character. He was a character. I mean, he was an amazing act.
Yeah, he and very he invented powerful. Everything. I mean,
yeah, but he was very good. And he would do this thing in his act with a bill, and he would say, "The shadow of your bill." And he'd sing this little line. I'm like, oh, he said, God, this guy could sing.
Yeah.
I mean, he has a great voice. And I said, mm-hmm. Ricky, you got a great voice. And he just put it aside. When he passed away, Norm Nielsen was helping with his estate. He found these reel-to-reels.
Mm-hmm.
They were demo reels from a studio.
Mm.
And he put them onto a regular, I guess, on the CDs.
CD, yeah.
And at his memorial, he played them, and it sounded like Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
He was an unbelievable singer.
I did not
But he
know
never
that.
Felt he was good enough. He was very hard on himself.
Yeah.
But the song, he sounded unbelievable. He was like a crooner.
Yeah.
Hmm. And nobody knew that.
No.
And he kept it to himself.
He never shared that with magicians.
No.
I did not know that side of him.
No. And even when I mentioned it on stage, like he just, whatever. He never said, I used to sing, or I wanted to sing. Nope. But he had demo reels.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a fascinating story. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. Let me ask you, as I always do all my guests, what your magic word is, or what is that's important to you? What is the reason you wake up in the morning? What do you live by?
Oh.
It could be a sentence or a word or a phrase. Or
mine is, as I get older, is enjoying every day, everything you do, mm-hmm. as much as you can. Sometimes it's not easy, but enjoying it. You know, and if you could share that with other people, like what we do, magic is great for that. You know,
sure.
But enjoying your days go by quickly.
Boy, don't they?
You know,
we're getting older.
We have friends that leave. Dean Dale passed away mm-hmm. recently. I've had some different friends pass away recently. And you go, wow, life is short, man. You better enjoy it.
Yeah.
So enjoy it.
That is fantastic. Thank you very much for the magic word. That was Tony Clark. Until next time, this is Scotty out. Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and we are sitting here at the Owl Bar, and have just finished talking a little bit with Tony Clark, and now I've got a person who's starring in the Palace this week, Jonathan Neal, or Jay Neal. How do you go by Jay?
I use them all.
Okay.
Jay Neal, Jonathan Neal, Jonathan Neal Brown, all of it.
Because I remember you, of course, as Jonathan Neal Brown.
Right.
I when we worked together at the Magic Island in Houston, so very
That's
many
right.
years ago.
That's
you know?
Right.
I think I was working close up, and you were in the States uh-huh. when I first got to know you very well. You've been performing for a long time. How many weeks a year would you say that you come here to the castle to work?
Oh, the castle used to be a big part of my year, but it's not really anymore. I probably work 3, maybe 4 weeks max anymore.
Because you're busy other places?
Other places, yeah.
Cruise ships around the world?
Cruise ships. I think last year I was on ships 28 or 29 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and that's about average for me. So
yeah.
I have about 4 weeks or so. Once or twice maybe in the palace. Once in the parlor,
right?
You know, so on.
That seems to be part of the problem with a person who is out to sea. They're out of mind, also.
Right. So. I don't know that if I was sitting around here in town waiting for the phone to ring, whether they'd book me anymore. Anyway,
yeah.
There was a time when I was work here 6 to 10 weeks a year,
mm-hmm.
and it was pretty regular.
Yeah.
But there are a lot more people in L.A., and there's also more theaters, but still the demand is high. So
right, right. Yeah. Well, I would think so. Now a lot of people have moved from L.A. to Vegas, made that
right.
exit as many years ago, I guess, and then they kind of filled up with so many people that they can hardly get $100 an hour, seems like,
well,
you know, in Vegas.
Yeah, the economy has changed in terms of marketing a magic show or a magic act. The values have changed.
Mm-hmm.
I worked and lived in Vegas for about a year and a half mm-hmm. when I was working at Caesar's Magical Empire.
Yeah. That was a good run.
Wonderful, sweet gig.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was perfect. But when it closed, I wasn't going to sit around waiting for another show.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I could see their handwriting on the wall in that town.
Yeah.
With the advent and the popularity of all those Cirque du Soleil shows, it was watering down the price point of many individual variety entertainers,
right.
jugglers, acrobats, and that sort of thing. And I could see magic would be that way, too.
I had heard that some time ago. I remember Jeff Hobson talking about how they had some of the producers had paid less and less and less to the performers,
right?
Particularly magicians, I guess. And it seems like at the end of the Greek Isles, when they used to have the world's magic, greatest magic show, whatever it was, that they finally just said, we will not pay anybody, but we'll let any magician who wants to come into town work for free, just so that way you can say you worked in Vegas. I mean, it got horrible.
Yeah, and it just continued to devalue. I think the last good contract I got out of Vegas was probably at the Empire.
Wow.
And then years later, I was doing a lot of corporate work, And then the last casino show I did was for Tony Clark, interestingly enough, up in Tahoe.
Yeah.
And I was there for a little over a year.
That was great. At the Horizon.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And that was a nice gig. Again, beautiful situation. Perfect, really.
We were just talking about that because I've got a timeshare in Tahoe, and I used to go up there, and I had seen everybody who had been working there. And I may have missed the year that you were. Who worked with you?
I was with Christopher Hart and Danny Cole and Joel Ward, and it was called TV's Magic Stars.
I remember that. I did not see the show that year, but I remember that was. And the nice thing about that, of course, is that you just stay in one casino the whole time, and it's a
wonderful.
1 year deal. Yeah. The bad part is you can't ski. Because of the contract, I guess?
Well, I can't ski anyway.
Okay.
So I know my limitations. But I had worked that same venue when it was the Sahara Hotel, and then the High Sierra Hotel, and the Horizon. So I knew the room, and I had worked it up in Tahoe a number of times. So it was wonderful coming back.
Yeah, he said now that they've apparently torn down the room, and it's a Hard Rock Hotel, and it's nothing like that.
No.
So that's gone.
It was that beautiful little, they used to call it the Pinecone Lounge.
Okay, that was a while back.
Yeah, it was, was one of the first casino gigs I did. Around 1980 was the first time I worked that room.
Okay.
So that we're going back a few years.
Now, from L.A., how far of a drive would that be if you were going to be... Where were you living at the time, back then, in 80?
In 80, I was living about a block and a half from the Magic Castle.
Okay.
But I was with a touring review show, and we went to Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, and then we went to Savannah, Georgia, and then it went to Tahoe. And we were there probably in Tahoe for 2 months.
Right, right. You know. Let me ask you how you keep up such a great high-energy show. I just love your show.
Oh,
first of all, I've always been an admirer of yours, silently. We've not talked a lot about how much that I really do admire you as one of my favorite magicians. But, you know, seeing you the other night on stage and, interacting with the audience, and I just love the music. And it's almost of a different era.
It is.
You know?
It is consciously of a different era.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of magic that almost doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, right. And it's not cheesy, you know, that I could see some magicians using Frank Sinatra, and it's like, oh, this guy is just making a goof of it. But, I mean, yours is so smooth and beautiful, and, it gives me goosebumps.
Well, thanks. You know, I grew up, we all do what we see. You know, you emulate what you saw in your formative years.
Sure.
And although I didn't grow up in Los Angeles, I was greatly influenced by the Marvin Roys, the Channing Pollocks, the cabaret acts, you know, Shimada. When I moved out here, I met them all and was fortunate enough to meet them and become friends with them all.
That's nice.
And it was always a big influence on me, and that's the kind of magic that I enjoyed seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became the kind of magic that I enjoyed doing.
Sure.
And so it is of another time. There's now in magic, it kind of takes a couple of paths. There's the close-up path, the David Blaine, you know, get a television special, doing small magic on television, become a star. And there's the opulent David Copperfield, Siegfried and Roy route.
Mm-hmm.
But almost nobody continues to do a small cabaret act, if you will, in these kind of settings, because the nightclubs don't exist for it.
Mm-hmm.
They do out on ships.
Right.
On ships, you can do 45 minutes of cabaret magic, and it fits certain ships, and you can expand it to other ships.
Right.
So it's there. And it's just the kind of magic I enjoy seeing, and I like doing it. It is, I think I'm the last of that era.
I can't think of many others who can do what you do, particularly as well as you do, but certainly that to do a true cabaret, because the cabaret theaters don't exist. It's almost like a vaudeville that has passed.
Yes.
You know?
And the trick for me is to maintain the values that I admire. You know, to me, it's about polish and precision and accuracy and connecting with the audience, and not make it seem like it's too dated.
Yeah.
In other words, a Chavez act technically is highly accomplished,
but
does it mean what it meant to an audience 40 years ago? How do you make it mean something to a modern audience without looking stilted or rarefied?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that to me is part of my job too, is to take something that's not inherently of interest to the people. You know, they don't care about silk tricks per se.
Right.
I have to find a way to make them care about those props, because it's not something they deal with anymore. It's not, you know, they don't go to Fred Astaire movies. They don't appreciate polish.
Yeah.
If polish doesn't look right, then it looks cheesy. It looks like old school.
Well, James DeMare comes to mind.
James DeMare manages to make the leap.
Yeah.
He does it as a period piece and perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do the similar thing and still keep it contemporary.
Right.
Even though much of the music I use might be from another era.
Right,
I try to find a way into their heads where what I'm doing maybe has a new appeal.
Do you get a lot of compliments then from a younger group today, or are you still a lot of people like my age are coming in and say, oh, I love the music and this is great and classic?
Well,
are you getting the Criss Angel kind of audience?
I certainly don't see them on ships. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it's older, richer clientele, so you don't see them on ships. But it's nice to see that here at the Castle, for example, Friday night, third show, 11:30, and they're half drunk out of their gourds. And yet, they were the strongest reaction of the evening was that young crowd late night.
Yeah.
Somehow, what I was doing connected with them. Maybe it's the energy that they see.
Right.
You know, even if they don't maybe enjoy a particular piece of music, I find a way that through my conviction, through my willingness to push at it, to get them to respond, and they do.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the reward for me.
How do you keep that energy? I mean, do you work out like every day or something?
Yeah.
You look like you're just in great shape, and the kind of way you dance across the stage.
It's a commitment.
Yeah.
I'm at a point now where you have to help nature.
Yeah, that's true at our age, I guess.
You reach a certain age and you're not 25 anymore, and the calories just don't melt away.
Yeah, your mind is still thinking that, but your body's saying, I'm not there anymore. Yeah.
Your body wants to slow down constantly.
Sure.
So, yeah, I run 5 miles every morning.
Do you?
Yeah, and if I'm feeling it all, I'll do another 5 miles at night. You know, six and six, I call it. If I'm working a show week, I just do it in the morning, and I don't do it at night because that energy's for the audience.
Yeah.
But it's a commitment.
Wow.
Having said that, I'm not a vegetarian. I eat as much junk food as I want.
And meats and everything. Yeah.
But I'm willing to pay the price.
Yeah.
Because I think I owe it to the audience. In order to sell my style, I have to maintain a certain physicality.
I think you have to, because you have a physical kind of a show. I mean,
yeah. Mm-hmm. But I love doing it, and you know, if the audience is receptive,
you got some of the classics in there. Then also, I like the way that you've updated some things. And that one thing always comes to mind was the thing I remember you used to do with a rope, and you put in your teeth. And you would do the soak through the rope. I mean, forever. I think that's one of your trademark things that I think.
Well, it is. But I stole that, quote unquote, it. Of course, it's in Tarbell, and there were a number of magicians who did it in the vaudeville era. But the fellow who did it, who I saw do it, was Dick Gustafson.
Sure.
And I saw him when I was about 14 or 15 at an event called Willard Smith's Picnic in Massachusetts, which is an annual New England get-together back in those days.
Yeah.
And someone said, oh, Dick Gustafson's going to arrive. And he didn't do his whole candle act, but he did the cut and restored silk, and he did two or three things. And he so impressed me, he so very much impressed me, that I wanted to learn that and do it in a similar but not exactly the same manner.
All right.
Years fast forward, I've been doing it now in my act, of course, and I'm working in Atlantic City, and I'm riding up the service elevator from one of the theaters, and a young man comes up to me and says, you don't know me, but I play the bass in the lounge, in the band. And he says, I've seen you do that a number of times. You do it really great. My dad does that trick. And I said, really, what's your dad? He says, oh, my dad's Dick Gustafson. So I said, it's your dad's trick.
Yeah.
I said, I just learned it from him.
Yeah.
I said, I do it with my own way, but he's the inspiration. Tell your dad, you know. And I saw Dick years later, and, you know, we got to talking about it.
But also then updating other things, like with the gypsy thread and using the ball yarn and the music with Frank Sinatra, I just think is brilliant. I said, oh, my goodness. When you brought that out, I was thinking, okay, is there going to be a ring in the ball? But then it's like, oh, my. And using the audience volunteer, I mean, your ideas are very, very nice.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah. Sometimes that did pop into my head. I had already worked on the jumbo ball of thread, and I had it set with a jazz instrumental.
Yeah.
And I was out jogging one day, and I had a Frank Sinatra CD on, and it popped into my head about halfway through the run.
Yeah.
And I double-timed it back home while the idea was still fresh.
Uh-huh.
And it almost required no editing of the music.
Yeah.
It just fell into place.
Mm-hmm.
It really was good luck.
Yeah. You know. Very fortunate. Well, great. Well, I know you got to go, and I'm going to
well, thanks,
get
Scott.
Ready as well. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, so let me ask you, what is your magic word? What is it that is important to you? What is your life force, something you wake up in the morning, I mean, that you're going to do that is important, your chi, your...
Oh, well...
You know, it could be a sentence or word or phrase or
a
story.
What comes to mind is balance and proportion.
Good.
Energy and precision.
Balance and proportion, energy and precision.
Balance, proportion, energy, and precision.
Yeah.
You know, I think you have to keep all the elements in your life in balance. and in the right proportion. You know, if you spend too much time practicing, you maybe let your relationships suffer.
Right.
You have to find a balance between what you love to do, what you have to do,
yes,
what you're doing for other people, what you're doing for yourself,
mm-hmm,
and that all goes into the balance and proportion.
Right.
And of course, the precision and the excitement or energy is what I do for I'm looking for every day in performance.
Every day,
yeah.
Have to keep those in mind. Well, great. Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate
it. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
It's great talking with you for the Magic Word Podcast. That was Jonathan Neil Brown. This is Scotty Hill. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I'm getting ready to go and do my lecture here, but just a couple of minutes beforehand, I have with me Lee Delano, and you have been a member of the Magic Castle for how many years?
35.
And a performing magician, or just kind of like Carl Ballantyne, had an interest, kind of do it, but
well,
you've been an actor?
I've performed here a couple of times, but not, you know, not the close-up room, but for friends at the castle.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've been hosting the lectures here for about 30 years.
Yes.
Co-hosting
the lectures with Dave, I guess.
Yes. There,
yeah, too. And but you're an actor, and you've had a lot of parts, and some of the things that, just kind of name a few things.
I worked about 40 years in the business. I did over 100 television shows. I've worked with everyone from Lucille Ball, Sid Caesar. I worked with Sid and Imogene Coca for a period of 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
We worked on Broadway. We worked in cruise ships. We worked in different nightclubs. We worked in Las Vegas. We worked in Atlantic City, and we had a great. It was wonderful. It was the highlight of my life.
Yeah. Any great story? Something comes to mind immediately? Do you think of it?
The thing that comes to mind is that I enjoyed all the. There were a couple of shows that I thought. I wasn't crazy about some of the actors in the show. They were hard to get along with, but
okay.
I don't want to mention them.
Sure.
But
that was live TV back then, too.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I enjoy telling about is people say, well, you worked with Sid and Imogene for over 30 years. Do you have any stories? And one story is, they say, how did you meet Sid? I told them. I was working in a off-Broadway type show out here in California called The Typist and Tiger, a two-character play with a friend, a woman named Mary Carver, a wonderful actress. And we got very good reviews. And one night, somebody came backstage and said, you know, I represent Sid Caesar. He's looking for a straight man, second banana.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wow. He said, Sid might be interested in you. Would you like to meet him? No promises. I said, sure.
Yeah.
So the next day, he picked me up, and I went with him to Sid Caesar's house. We went, we sat down, and Sid came up to me and he said, tell me, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from New York. He said, do you come from New York? Do you know that there are a lot of Hispanic people in New York? And I caught on what he was doing. I replied, yes, I know New York very well. Very mucho Hispanic people there. My people are Hispanic, which they really aren't.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, so he went on like this with the Spanish accent. After about a minute, he said, by the way, there's also Irish people there. You know, Irish people in Yorkville. It's a section in... I said, well, of course I do know that. And we started talking like this. And then a little later, he did a German. So I did a German. He did an Italian. I did an Italian accent. And he said, where the heck did you learn all those accents? I said, the same way you did. My dad had a shop, and these immigrants would come in with different accents.
Yeah.
And I used to sit there and pick it up. He said, well, I did the same thing. My folks had a diner.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at his manager who was there. And he says, book the man. Sign him up.
Wow.
And that's the reason. And I've told many young actors, don't just play yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Be able to play comedy. Because I've done comedy. I've played heavies. In fact, my nom de plume is Crooks, Cops, and Comedy.
Yeah.
Someone gave me that title years ago because I played a lot of crooks, I played a lot of cops,
mm-hmm,
I did a lot of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
The more versatile you are, not only as an actor, but even as a magician, you just don't do just one style of magic. Do very various styles.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have friends of mine who are wonderful actors, and I've worked much more than them, because if they said, we need somebody who's Spanish or French or German, I was able to go for those parts with these friends of mine who only played themselves, didn't get the opportunity.
Right, right. And I know you were in Star Trek. I was looking at that clip over there in which you were like a gangster, I think, and they gone back
in time. It was called A Piece of the Action, and they land on a gangster planet, and I was one of the head gangsters.
Yeah.
And it was tremendous amount of fun, but I'll tell you a very funny thing. The person who played Scotty, Jimmy Doohan,
mm-hmm.
was one of my teachers when I was at the Neighborhood Playhouse. I was born and raised in New York City, and this... one of my teachers at the Neighborhood Playhouse, which was a wonderful acting school, they taught you acting and they taught you modern dance and with Martha Graham and ballet. I had to take ballet.
Yeah.
And some of my classmates were Steve McQueen, mm-hmm. Joanne Woodward, Mark Rydell, the great director Mark Rydell, Sidney Pollack, another great director.
Wow.
And I went there from 1950 to 1952. And then I was drafted in the Army in 1952. And I was during the Korean War, but I didn't go to Korea, thank God. They sent me to Europe, and I was in special services.
Mm-hmm.
And I entertained for the next 2 years in Berlin, Germany.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate, and I'm still fortunate.
And we were talking earlier before I turned on the recording over here about your friendship with Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and those guys, and you get together with them from time to time.
Well, when Sid started to get sick and he wasn't able to perform anymore, we used to go to his home and maybe once every couple of months, and Mel Brooks always showed up, and so did Carl did occasionally, but... there were so many people in the business that would come. Mm-hmm. We had a cadre of about 30 people, and we had wonderful times with mm-hmm. Sid. He was so good to me. He was a wonderful thing. One thing about Sid, he always said to me when I first started working with him, he said, never talk down to people. Always uplift yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He said, because people come here to be entertained, and he always felt an obligation to people. And even after the show, when people came up to him for autographs, he was so gracious.
Yes.
He was a true gentleman. And the same with...
People person.
Mm-hmm. And the same with Imogene Coca, one of the sweetest, dearest human beings I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just wonderful to work with. We traveled, as I said before, we did nightclubs, we did Las Vegas... And it was very thrilling for me to see my name up in lights in Las Vegas when it said, Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca with Lee Delano. I thought, my God, I'm the with.
The with. Now, Jack Benny and...
No, I never met Jack Benny, okay. But I did meet George Burns. Yeah. I worked with Carol Burnett. I worked with Lucille Ball. I worked with Cesar Romero. These are probably names that the young people don't know. And
we have a wide listenership.
What?
I said we have a wide listenership.
Oh, so. Good, good. Yeah, and I work with so many of the old timers. It was just wonderful.
Yeah.
I work with.
Well, I tell you what, as we start to close up, because I'm going to have to go up and get the tables ready and everything again for the lecture, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. You've had such a wonderful life, and you've met a lot of people. What is your magic word? What is it? It could be a word, a phrase, a sentence. What's important to your life? I mean, at this point in
your
life...
I'll tell you what's important in my life. There was a wonderful poetess, Maya Angelou,
sure.
And she once said something I never forgot. She said, people won't remember... who you are or what you did, but they will never forget how you made them feel.
Mm.
And that to me is so important. In life, it's how you make people feel that they will always remember.
Right.
And that's been my way of dealing with people.
And I think it's important not only in life, certainly on stage as a magician,
yes.
because that otherwise it's just bubblegum for the eyes. You need
Absolutely.
To do something where people actually have an emotional connection with you.
Absolutely,
you know?
Right.
That's great. Well, Lee, thank you very much.
Thank
I appreciate
you so
your time
much.
Over
my,
there.
My pleasure.
All right. And for The Magic Word, this is Scotty out. Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I'm here with Christopher Hart and Ray Pierce. Hey, guys.
How are you?
I'm
Hi.
Doing great, great. And, you know, Ray, that we started off with part one of my
week at the Magic Castle, and I was talking with Howard Hamburg and Newell Lunford, and he was talking about you working with at the Hollywood Magic. So it's full circle, I guess, because I'm finishing my last podcast and actually talking with somebody he was telling stories about.
Well, not just him, but of course Jonathan, Jay Neal is working this week. That was really, and I still credit to this day, Hollywood Magic is what made me a magician. Mm-hmm. And the reason is when you do a show and you might flash something or something like that, nobody really tells you.
Yeah.
But when you have somebody walking off of the street and you say, let me show you something, and you do it, and you flash, you do something guilty, they say, wait, it's in the other hand. They tell you right away.
Yes.
And so we would test ourselves every day, and that's what gave us the ability to try to make stuff good.
He was saying also that you guys played a lot of practical jokes on each other.
Constantly. We would do stuff constantly. We would hide things in the counter. We would change the titles of things. We would do anything just to mess each other up.
Yeah.
And our goal was to see if we could keep a straight face.
Yeah.
Because it was an acting exercise. Everything we did in there was an acting exercise. But what we would do sometimes, in addition to practical jokes, we would come up with jokes on other magicians. Oh. And we took the color cube, which is most people know is a little trick. You put it in with a certain color showing, and we'd have a magician come in. We'd say, show me something. We'd say, okay, put a color in, and he'd turn back around and go red. And he goes, wait, you didn't pick it up. You didn't do anything. You have to do it again. And so he'd put another color in, and we wouldn't even touch the box. We'd turn around and go green. He goes, what are you doing? Unbeknownst to him, one of us was on the other side of the store fixing the books on the shelves.
Yeah.
And at that time, Max Maven had all these different colored mentalism books.
Yes.
And so all we do is we just pick up the red book. We'd glimpse it, pick it up, he'd turn around and go red. And they go, what are you doing with that? We were just holding up the color.
So we
would constantly mess with people. That's what made us have fun in there, too.
That's a great story. Did you have any people who came in that were interesting that...
on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You've got to remember, those days, Orson Welles would come in and sit down on the stool and sit there for 15, 20 minutes.
Just hang out.
Johnny Carson, everybody came in there.
Mm-hmm.
We had Henry Winkler come in from a movie set because he couldn't figure out how to do a magic trick.
Okay.
And we had to show him, and he was in makeup, and he literally went right back on set to do
really?
It. So we said Hollywood Magic is where the stars stop to shop.
Yeah.
And it's really true. Not just the stars of theater, film, TV, but of magic.
Yeah.
Because they would come up to work at the castle, and then during the day, they would all come in and hang out.
Mm-hmm.
And we would tell stories and keep them up with what the dirt was that was going on.
Yeah.
And it became really the place where people got to hang out and chat.
Right.
And we would learn amazing magic, and not only is training for us,
mm-hmm.
but they'd say, what's the newest thing?
Sure.
What do you got? What's this new? Yeah. Say, let me show you this. I haven't showed anybody else.
Yeah.
But we'd get out these little gems that came in, and it became the hub for magic in California.
Yeah.
And it was just the greatest joy ever.
There are so many things that are coming out now. I'm wondering if you think that there are more things that are coming out now than there were before, or not?
The fact is, yes, there are, but they don't have the same concentrated power.
Mm-hmm.
Because when something new came in at Hollywood Magic, that night we would come up to the Magic Castle here, and there was a place called the Conjurer's Corner. It was over by the palace, and everybody would get around, and we'd say, this just came in from Tenyo. This thing's brilliant.
Yeah.
And we would show it, and the next day we would sell out.
Wow.
So it was more concentrated because everybody knew about it right away.
Sure.
Now there's 5,000 tricks. Everybody's got a new variation on some internet thing.
Yeah, YouTube.
And it doesn't have the same power because it's kind of dissipated by all the... so much material out there.
Yeah.
That I love the power of one new thing came out and everybody knew about it in one day.
You're right. What was the one particular trick that actually sold more than others or used that? Like,
anything.
Flew off the shelf?
There was just anything that came in that was clever. When Tenyo first started coming out with stuff, it was just plastic. It had a very negative connotation.
Yeah, but the zigzag cigarette, for an example.
Exactly. And we get, okay, it's clever. But the one that really I remember is the Crystal Cleaver. I think Crystal Cleaver. Where you put the sword in and you put it down and linked into the metal box.
Yeah.
Fooled the heck out of people, including all of us when we saw it demoed the first time. And we came up and did it at the castle. That the one with the spot with the two plates that you squeeze. Squeeze plate, That one, another one. We saw a guy come in and do that, and he was a master of this from Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And he came in and did stuff that you couldn't believe with this.
Yeah.
He would do it and tap it and sleeve the extra piece.
Oh.
He'd come up and tap it with one hand. We're going, what is he doing?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
But you got to remember, in Tokyo, these magic demonstrators were the best in the business,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and we learned from them how to make something strong.
Right.
And they would take a stupid little plastic trick, and they would refine it and practice it and polish it and make a great presentation, and that was our goal.
Now, would you take things home and work on it, or just practice there at the office?
We had enough time there.
Yeah.
We had, I mean, that's all we did. You've got to remember that during the day, there weren't that many people on the boulevard. There'd be magicians that would come in, and we'd work there. But all day long, we had 8 hours a day just to polish something, and each day, Jonathan and I would pick up a trick and say, let's take this trick, which is not really doing anything. How can we make it better?
Mm-hmm.
You know what? If we did it and switched out this and did this and moved over here, and we would keep working on it until it became something that people could not leave without buying.
Yeah.
And that's our goal. It wasn't to sell it. It was to make the magic so strong that you went, I've got to have that.
Yes.
And that was our goal. And it was the greatest proving ground in the history for me.
Wow. Oh, there are some things still that you do in your act that...
Constantly.
Really?
I'll give you an example. I do a presentation of the mental photography deck, which nobody does. It's a weird trick. They're blank. There's face on it. It's obviously a gimmick deck.
Yeah.
And we came up with a routine in there that I still open with in the parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And people went, that's the greatest trick ever. I went, yeah, it's $5 down in the magic shop. But it was just such an offhand little thing that seems... Mm-hmm. And I basically came out and said, I've got to get warmed up. These are practice cards. These aren't real cards.
Yeah.
And you just start practicing, warming up with them. And people just stare at you because
mm-hmm.
they're all blank. And I say, oh, I've got... It's kind of odd. You probably don't know how magicians practice. But we practice with cards that are blank on the back and blank on the front. So if you drop them,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't matter how you pick them up.
Right.
You know, you just pick them up and keep warming up and work on your cuts, your shuffles. Of course, if they're real cards, there'd be faces on them.
Mm-hmm.
This is an example of a face, but these don't have faces. These are blank on the back. And you just keep going through,
sure.
and people just went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we did it 10 times a day in the shop, and
mm-hmm.
you just keep working out the lines.
Sure.
And I can't not do it. It was so much fun to do these stupid little tricks. And I grew up doing a Svengali pitch that I'll do to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And a tight 10-minute, and I'll move a dozen of them every time I do it. So I loved, I even at the cast, and I haven't done this. Chris, we talked about this a long time ago. I wanted to do the close-up room,
because mm-hmm.
I've never done the close-up room. And I did close-up for years.
Sure.
Close-up room, and I want to put a counter like we had at Hollywood Magic, a glass top counter,
sure,
and have all the tricks sitting on the shelves.
Okay.
And when they come in, I just reach and said, here's a little something I got in you the other day, and do the routine we used to do there.
Yeah.
Because unbeknownst to most people, at Hollywood Magic, we had behind the counter, there were mirrors in the back so you could see the tricks, but behind it, we had a Cervante.
Mm-hmm.
And we mastered it
mm-hmm.
to the degree that we would do stuff with that people had no clue of. And we were constantly ditching and retrieving, adding cards, switching decks, anything, and it made it into a miracle.
Right.
And I said, if I could have that with me all the time,
mm-hmm.
I could do the same miracles I did in there, and it spoiled us. Because
yeah,
we could do tricks we couldn't do anywhere else.
Yeah, the difference with me, Christopher Hart, is that I worked in this shop with Ray. And I never used the Cervant because I felt too guilty.
When he was a purist.
Because when they went home and they weren't able to vanish that thing
the same way
like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then they would come back and they'd say to Ray, I don't know how you did that part in the thing. And Ray talked his way out of it and showed
I explained
another
it. No, I explained. Now, you can do it with your pocket. We do it a different way.
Right. Yeah.
But here's how I would do it if I were you. And we
mm-hmm.
teach them. They go, oh, that's really clever.
Right.
But we loved coming up with ways of doing stuff that you couldn't do any other way.
Mm-hmm.
We had a routine for the sponge balls. So my favorite routine, we had these counters with all these drawers in them filled with junk of all the different tricks. And we had one drawer that was all the extra sponge balls. There were sponge squares and balls and the number one and the number four and all the weird things they had.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody said, let me see that sponge ball trick, I would grab as many of them as I could and shove them in the Cervante. It didn't matter what it was.
Yeah.
And the entire routine is, here, examine that ball. Look, okay. If you twist it, look what happens. It turns into two, and I'd set them down. And they try to do it. I said, no, let me show you again. Look, you just twist it, turn it, and set it down. And every time I just
grab
picking
another.
Up another handful of balls and just keep twisting it. And that was the entire routine.
Yeah.
And they say, how much is that? I said, $35. I'd get them five bags of sponge balls.
Yeah.
And they go out. And I say, if you tear it at a corner, look, it turns into a square. And that was the entire. And you'd have people all up and down the counter doing this. You'd have five people lined up.
Yeah.
All doing the same routine. And the great part is, after a while, you wouldn't even need to pick up. You just pick two up off the counter. And just tear them apart because they weren't watching at that point.
Right.
And you just kept going. And it was a 5-minute routine of just splitting sponge balls. That was the entire thing.
Wow.
And it was the most fun for us just to see how long we could get that routine and make it work.
Some of the things, Chris, that you can remember that...
I will say Ray was the master of the demo and pulling wools over people's eye. He was the king of that, and I sat in awe.
It's our job.
Yeah.
It's our job, really, if you think about it.
But I, you know, again, he was saying a lot of celebrities came in. Johnny Carson, Muhammad Ali was his favorite place to come in.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I got to really know David Copperfield well and later mm-hmm. worked for him in his Vegas shows and television specials. So it was really the hub. There was really no other magic shop, and people coming from out of the country would visit there, go to the Magic Castle, and later when I had my own act, I'd revisit those same people in the
mm-hmm.
you know, as I started to tour. So
mm-hmm.
I developed a lot of great relationships through the shop as well. So.
Wow.
Well, and Michael Jackson would come, and Muhammad Ali. These are amazing people, and we literally shut the shop down.
Yeah.
Michael was amazing because he loved magic. Oh, like a little kid.
Uh-huh.
And he'd be standing in the back, and he had a sixth sense about when people had figured out it was him. And he would, we'd be showing him a trick, and he'd be invested in the trick and engaged. And all of a sudden, he would stop, and you'd get this look in his eyes. He'd go, "I've got to go in the back." We'd go, "Okay, Mike, come on back." Yeah. And we'd lead him to the back room. And he loved when we did this. We'd come back out, and the people would always come up and say, "Is that Michael Jackson?" We said, "Who?" The guy back there said, "Johnny?" "Oh, no, he's the guy down on the Man's Chinese Theater that stands on the street. He looks just like him, doesn't he?" Michael used to get the biggest kick out of that. He'd go, do the thing about me on the street. He said, "Oh, yeah, that's, he does the Michael Jackson impersonator. Yeah. He's great. Do you think Michael Jackson would come in here dressed like that? Come on, who are you kidding?"
Really?
So, we had the best time with those. And that's the thing. We there were our friends. There were people that came in to have fun.
I mean, the other thing is that Muhammad Ali would come in, and you'd see this big Rolls Royce pull up front. And in the beginning, it was like, "Oh, my God, who is that?" And it was Muhammad Ali. And then we were excited. And then it got to the point where he didn't have a lot of skill set. So we'd have to end up selling him the same trick. He had like three tricks he could technically, physically do. So after a while, it was harder and harder to sell stuff to him. And so in the end, we'd see the Rolls pull up and say, "No, it's your turn to help him. No,
you've got to come up with something for him this time."
But he would say it was his favorite place to come. And he had a fishing tackle box filled with all his tricks. And then, you know, I just remember him saying, "Oh, it's too messy," and he'd pour all the tricks out onto the counter, and he was putting the little sponge balls and the paddle moves on the compartments, and I thought, "Wow, this is the world's greatest fighter of all time." But the thing about magic is that you're unified on the same level. Not, you know, that's why Johnny Carson's, Michael Jackson's, why we do magic.
Yeah.
That same love of it is that childlike love that doesn't matter your celebrity status. So that's what was fun.
Or whatever
to
your
see.
Profession is, doctor, lawyer, dentist,
what you are,
taxi driver.
They're still a kid.
I remember Magic Island, and you'll tell me the name, but a famous, famous judge.
Oh, yeah, Frank Price?
Frank Price.
And
I just was like, he would tell me these horrific cases he would have to do in trial. And then, but his peace and happiness came from doing magic.
Exactly. And he did it very smoothly.
The fact is that they were these incredibly charismatic, magical people in their own right, that with all this great history, but they didn't ever want to talk about that. They wanted to talk about magic. They would talk about the latest thing. I'm going, but you're amazing. I want to hear these stories. No. Tell me about that card trick again.
Yeah, they're tired of talking about that part of their life.
This is new to them.
Their hobby. Yeah. Interesting. Great stories. Well, thank you guys very much. That's kind of cool to kind of hear the old days of Hollywood magic.
Oh, it was the greatest part of life. If you think about it, between working at the magic shop during the day and then coming up to the magic castle at night, it's what made us who we are.
We got to
study and see so many great people and put it to the test.
That's true. Yeah, I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for Hollywood magic, and it's sad that it's closed now, and I think I'm really fortunate that it was open during that time in my life when it was most important. It was sort of like a little guardian angel guiding me to my career.
And at that time, if you remember, we had Jules Lanier, Michael Skinner, Earl Nelson,
Johnny Platt
in there.
Charlie Miller.
And this is as good as it got, and working in there with them.
Yeah.
And we would sit during the day and say, give me a hand on this. I'm trying to make this work. He goes, move your finger over to here and do that. And then we'd come up to the Magic Castle at night, and Vernon was here.
Sure.
And he would sit over there and go, "Hold it. Now put your little finger in the thing. Don't hold it like that."
And I was part of it. Ray kind of thankfully took me under his wing. I moved to Hollywood when I was 20. And so Ray was working at the shop, Jonathan Neal. And so there's a little group of us, Don Wayne, who was a magic consultant for David Copperfield. So we had a little group of our little magic group. And so we'd go to Johnny's Steakhouse across the street.
On Monday nights.
On Monday nights. And here at the end of the month, they'd have an audition night. So we'd have their steak, $2.95 steak and salad.
And it was great.
It was great back in the day. And then we'd come up, and David Copperfield and I and Ray and Jonathan would be in the back row watching the audition nights here. So it's a time and era that will never be back.
Yeah.
But it was a really amazing time to be.
It's great to hear those stories of those days gone by.
It was the most amazing time. And again, each generation has their own moment.
Well, of course,
like
they're creating new ones now.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was such a great moment. And I look back on with so much fondness and say, that's what made me learn about great magic and seeing it up here. So a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, let me close because I want to ask you what your magic word is. The name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so I've asked Crisp about his before, but what would be your magic word? And it wouldn't have to be a word. It could be a philosophy of life. What is it you live by? What's important to you?
For me, there's so many things, but for me, it really, I've said that the secret for creativity, which is what we love about magic, is not just the imagination, but is about letting go of what keeps us from being creative. And that is stress, tension, fear, overanalyzing, all those things. It's good to do that from a technical background.
Yeah.
But pure creativity is this complete openness to accept anything.
Yes.
And say, I don't care. Let's try it. Let's see what it is. And then you can systematically analyze it. But for me, it's about letting go.
Yeah.
And I've said, I teach the flying trapeze now. And I say flying trapeze is not about holding on. It's about letting go.
Letting go.
Of right. what keeps you from flying. Mm-hmm. And it's also metaphorically what keeps you from moving forward in your life. Same thing with magic. When I am at my freest, I'm at my most creative. And that's when I'm willing to take the most risks creatively right. for magic and come up with the most ideas that I never would have thought of. Because mm-hmm. I just go, let go of all that restriction, that restrictive thinking.
Wow.
So free, just being free, yeah.
Exactly. Great. Thank you, Ray, very much. Thank you, Christopher. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
For the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out.
Well, it's a wrap. It was only a week for me, but 6 for you. I hope that you enjoyed this extended series of chats with magic friends, or as they may be called, the Knights of the Castle. I had a great time and learned a lot along the way. I hope you did too. I would like to hear your feedback on whether you enjoyed this series, whether it was too long or too short, and what and who you enjoyed the most. Perhaps even who you might like to hear in a longer conversation in some future podcast. And thanks goes out this week to 2 new friends of the Magic Word. A big shout out and thanks goes to Joseph Hanasek, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who made a donation to the Magic Word through PayPal. And then John Gaspard pledged his ongoing support through Patreon.com. It goes to show how easy it is for you to join your friends in showing your support by donating with a one-time donation or by becoming an ongoing patron and sponsor. Thank you guys so much for your financial support. It is because of you and many others like you who enjoy this podcast enough to make financial pledges that helps keep this podcast going. Next week, I will post a very special podcast with a secret someone who every magician knows, loves, and respects. Until then, stay well, get booked, and just floss the teeth that you want to keep. This is Scotty out.